Our next guest on Downtown is the author of several books, including Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, and I Wear the Black Hat. His newest has blown my mind clear around the world here. It's called But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. Chuck Klosterman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having me out.
Now, I have to settle something before we even get into talking about the book. Bill Simmons pronounced your last name Klosterman. Dan Patrick said Klosterman. Who's right?
Simmons.
So it's Klosterman.
It's Klosterman. You know, the thing is, yeah, there's no reason that anyone should know it's Klosterman. It looks like Klosterman. There's no umlauts over the O. But I just don't correct people. It doesn't bother me. I mean, I'm a writer, so they're looking at my name on paper. If someone gets it wrong, that's fine.
Do you wish you had
I'd probably correct you if you'd have called me Chuck Klosterman. I think if they get Chuck wrong, then I'll be like, well,
Do you wish you had an umlaut?
No, I think that would make texting harder.
All right, I understand completely. Well, the book is absolutely phenomenal. And did I hear right that it was watching the reboot of Cosmos that made you decide to basically question everything we think we know?
Well, I mean, that's partially. I mean, when I was watching the reboot of Cosmos, the thing that I found interesting is whenever they reference some sort of arcane scientist from like the 1400s to the 1500s to the 1600s who introduced an idea and it sort of changed the way the entire world thought about something, but within one generation, it was as if everyone had always thought that everything had changed, and yet people assumed like, oh, this is just how it is. And I thought to myself, well, that must be happening all the time. That must be happening now.
Well, let's start with talking about literature. Of course, here on a station owned by Stephen King, the question you pose is, who will be perceived as the greatest living writer down the road, perhaps a couple of hundred years? And you suggest that it's likely to be somebody we don't even know.
Well, it ultimately got to be one of three types of writers. Okay? It has to either be somebody who is assumed in the present tense to be among the greats, you know, John Franzen or Philip Roth, Jennifer Egan, somebody like that, Don DeLillo, okay. But the history of ideas seems to suggest that this will not happen, or if it does happen, it's sort of almost beating the odds, okay. So the other two possibilities then is that it will be somebody who is completely unknown, or somebody who is known but not really respected or taken seriously. And it's those last two categories I find interesting, because we always, of course, operate under the premise that who we think is the greatest talent now will be the greatest talent from this period forever. Even though when we look back on time, we see that's very rarely the case.
And the same thing applies to music as well. On a night when here in Little Old Bangor, Maine, we have Ringo Starr performing in town and Dave Matthews on the same night. But it may well be that when people look back at music, if they do, from this era, that they won't remember the Beatles or Dylan or Elvis, but that it could be, I don't know, Kansas maybe.
Well, you know, the thing is, rock music is especially sort of vulnerable for being remembered for arbitrary reasons. I mean, in a rational world, in a logical world, it is the Beatles who are sort of defining what rock was and what rock is. And if I really believe that the world were a logical place, and somebody asked me in 300 years, who will they remember? The obvious answer is probably the Beatles, followed by, you know, either maybe Dylan or Elvis. But we don't live in a rational world, and the way things are remembered often have less to do with merit and more with how the idea of memory works, or how the idea of importance changes.
When we talk about sports, you touch on football and the fact that there are those who believe football will disappear and that it's the violence that may bring it to an end. And you offer a couple of possibility for footballs. One, that it does go away because all team sports vanish, but also maybe the very thing that people might spell its demise could be what helps its survival.
It seems very possible to me that football will become a less popular but more important sport to the culture because it will take on a greater political meaning. That saying you're a football fan or that you want your kid to play football or that football should be, even legal or whatever at the high school level will be saying basically that maybe our society has moved too far away from the visceral physicality that sort of defined how America was built, and that the way our society is evolving, though quote-unquote enlightened, might be further away from sort of the core qualities that make people people. And maybe football will be this small sport that will still mean a lot, because the people who love it will really be saying something way beyond, "I like this sport." They'll be basically describing how they view life.
Does football turn into a rollerball?
I don't know. That would suggest that we would actually make rule changes to make football more violent. I don't know if that will happen, but it's an interesting idea.
As you look into the future and try to peer ahead and figure out what people will think down the road and what they'll believe, are we seeing a change, a fundamental change, Chuck, in what makes people smart and how we perceive intelligence?
I think so. I think so because of the Internet. I think that, you know, for the longest time, a lot of what we considered when we were talking about the idea of an intelligent person was really based in the size of their memory. Somebody was an expert on poetry because they could memorize a lot of poems. Somebody was good in a mathematical sense purely from their ability to remember theories and equations sort of in their mind. The Internet has changed that. It has taken away the necessity for that. You can become sort of a fluent, an expert in pretty much any subject instantly, assuming you have this very common device in front of you. So when you take away the importance of memory, it all becomes this idea of how can you recontextualize what you know or what the information we all know in order to make a different kind of point. I'm not necessarily saying this is good or bad. I mean, I can kind of see it both ways. But it does seem different. It seems very different to think that you can be a smart person without really knowing things, but being able to access them quicker than other people through machinery.
We're talking to Chuck Klosterman, or Klosterman. We're going with Klosterman. His brand new book is called "But What If We're Wrong?" Is this generation, or even, I don't know, maybe even the 20th and early 21st century, is this time different in the sense that we're so confident in what we know, or have people always been pretty sure that what they knew was the actual truth?
Well, okay, in one sense, that's an impossible question for me to answer. I'm only 44, so my memory of reality is really, if I'm 44 years old, it's really about 34 years or 35 years that I can start sort of kind of recognizing how I view the world to be. Now, in that time, within that window, those three decades or so, it does seem that there is a greater sense of certitude, because what seems to have happened is this. As there are more voices in the media, but also just in day-to-day life because of social media, because there are more opinions and ideas kind of put forward by a greater number of people, the only way to get noticed in the attention economy is to have a stronger opinion that's backed up by just a wall of certitude. That almost as though your argument is, you need to believe me because I'm clearly so confident and comfortable with this, that any sort of disagreement isn't just the other side, but absolutely absurd. So I think people have taken on almost like a mask of certainty, but if you wear that mask long enough, that's who you are.
Now, when we talk about the arts, we assume certainly there's some subjectivity in that, but science we've sort of viewed as more objective, but is that really the case, or is that quite open to interpretation?
Well, certainly no one in the scientific community would say that it's open to interpretation. They would say that the scientific method, which really kind of came into play in the 1600s, and that's when everything started to change, is based on experimentation. Nothing is verified unless you can verify it many times. And the way you sort of kind of double-check information is through math. If the math works and every experiment seems to indicate the same outcome, you have a real answer. Of course, it seems as though that this idea has existed before. Like, we're not the first generation of people to think that, well, we're really getting it right this time. That sort of raises even a harder question, though. Let's say the scientific community is correct, and at this time we really are right, and we're reaching kind of the end of knowledge in many ways. That really changes the meaning of the experience of being alive if you're a curious person. I mean, since the dawn of time, the idea has been a curious intellectual person wants to better understand the world. But let's say we're getting to the point where our understanding actually is right. Like, this time we are right. Then where do we go? I mean, like, what's the trajectory then, sort of human thought, if the information we have is the only information we need?
Now, you start with a pretty bold premise, which is just throwing out there that gravity, that thing that I think most of us would say, that I'm sure of, even that could be wrong because it has been before.
Well, yeah. Well, and the thing about that is when I was talking to various physicists about the idea of science, what I was saying was, you know, this is not a book where I'm trying to contradict your view of reality, because your view of reality is pretty much mine. You know, that I'm just trying to figure out what's the possibility that we're wrong. And then I would say, like, well, you know, I know some things are stable, some things are not up for debate, such as gravity. And one of these guys was like, no, it's not. And it was very early in the process. And that's when I thought to myself, this book will work. If the thing that I'm using as the ultimate example of an unchangeable idea is changeable, well, then everything is kind of worth thinking about.
Yeah. Now, Brian Greene, who you talked to a lot, certainly led you in that direction. But Neil deGrasse Tyson was not exactly buying into this right away, was he?
No. I mean, he's the one person in the book, and I think for justifiable reasons maybe, had a more of an adversarial relationship with these questions. I think partially because he's kind of become the face of science. So he's used to dealing with, say, climate change deniers or people who he would perceive as being anti-science, and I think he suspected that was my motive, which wasn't at all, but I think that was his suspicion, and he was like, I'm going to cut this off as early as I can. Like, I'm going to, you know, these questions you're asking about being wrong, we're not wrong. But, as I said before, it's not like he's the first guy who ever felt that way.
Now, I have to say, of all the ideas in the book, the one that made me step back and take a stiff drink was the notion that we're all living in a simulation. Can you explain that and why there are people out there who believe that to be the case?
Well, there's a lot of scientists who not necessarily believe this theory, but take it seriously. The idea that what we think is reality, kind of the experience we're having on Earth, the history of life, basically, is actually just a high-end version of a video game like The Sims or Civilization being played by someone, you know, thousands of years in the future. And that what we think is real, we're actually almost like characters in a game. And the logic for this actually is, you know, pretty airtight. It's like, you know, the first step is that we're already doing this, right? We're already playing games and kind of constructing worlds on a computer. Okay? And every year, and certainly every decade, those games become more sophisticated and more complicated. A version of a video game, of a false world video game now, compared to one 20 years ago, is unfathomable. So we have to assume that's going to keep going, right? That these games are going to get better and better and better, to a point where we have the potential to do it ourselves, essentially make a video game where the people inside that game think it's life, that they're self-aware, that they believe they're living a reality. Well, if we reach a point where we can do that, that means it can be done. And if it can be done, the odds that we are part of a game as opposed to the makers of the game are mathematically immense. It would seem to suggest that if we were actually living in the one real reality, it would be a complete 1 in 10 million shot. Now, I realize as I describe that, it sounds kind of confusing, but like, I feel like I described it away in the book that kind of brings up this kind of interesting idea. It's like, how are we supposed to live if it turns out we're not real?
Yeah, that's the point where I did that move that Wile E. Coyote would always do in the cartoons, where he went and to make it all make sense to me here. Now, you do have a chapter entitled A Brief Explanation as to Why This Book Is Hopeless and a Briefer Explanation as to Why It Might Not Be. After exploring these questions, are you more or less hopeful about the future?
Well, you know, many people have asked me that. They've asked me if this book makes me pessimistic or optimistic. And this might be kind of a strange answer, but I would say neither. I think what it has made me think is that the future and the meaning of the future and the meaning of the past is kind of a neutral charge. Like, things change, but they're not really getting better or worse. They're just becoming different. And difference always feels awkward to the person who remembered something else. I mean, you know, to the kind of person listening to this radio, this interview, like, say they grew up in the 60s and 70s, and they love listening to records on vinyl. And they look at music now, and it's all file sharing and MP3s and all of these things. They might feel very alienated from that. And they're like, oh, music sucks now. I don't like what has happened, you know. But from experience, they look back on the 60s and 70s and go like, well, how terrible it must have been to be in your house and only have access to 80 records when I have access to every song ever written.
Yeah.
Those are just differences, right? I think both of them are totally valid and good ways to experience music. Like, I missed the first wave. That's the kind of person I was in the 70s and 80s. But this difference is just that. It's only different. It doesn't really have a better or worse component.
And maybe the wise thing to do for future generations is to hang on to that Journey vinyl and those first edition Danielle Steele books.
Maybe so. Maybe those are the things that are going to be, for your grandkids, the most worthwhile objects you own.
Well, the book is absolutely wonderful. But what if we're wrong thinking about the present as if it were the past? Chuck Klosterman, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon, and continued success with the book.
Thanks for having me on.